with the European Union. We stand united with these Baltic states, and that we're just not off going alone.
Do you need China's support?
I think the impact of having all countries support it would be the best. But let's face it, having Europe and America stand together will make a difference.
Donald Trump has tapped Rex Tillerson as his pick for Secretary of State. He's someone with strong business ties in Russia and connections with Vladimir Putin. Could that be beneficial in trying to curb Russian aggression in the region?
Well, I have a lot of concerns over the fact that the Secretary of State nominee has praised Putin, has actually called for the lessening or elimination of sanctions, something that we think is really important for these Baltic countries and for America standing up against Russian aggression. So these are things that are going to be explored in these hearings at length. I find solace in the fact that there are some Republicans like Senator McCain and Senator Graham who are withholding judgment on the nominee because they want to get to the bottom of this.
What kinds of conversations have you been having with Eastern European leaders? Because these sanctions are coming at this already tense time between the U.S. and Russia. Do the sanctions make life more difficult for them as they're on the Russian border?
That's what's so incredible about these countries. And the sanctions are difficult for them, but yet they have been able to survive. And they believe so strongly in a united Europe and so strongly in NATO. That's their protection. They are too small of a country to go it alone, and they get that. They are concerned, yes, about some of the statements that have been made, like Newt Gingrich saying that Estonia was nothing more than a suburb of St. Petersburg. Yeah, that concerned them. At the same time, they know that Congress has stood with them, that there's bipartisan support, and that's why we came together. They also believe Senator McCain when he has said that he is directly spoken to the president-elect and that he has said that he will continue to support NATO. So our mission here is to stand tall with these countries, to answer their questions about what was a very volatile election in the U.S., and to tell them that we will have a smooth transition of power and that there is strong bipartisan support in the Congress for going after the cyber attacks and for standing true to their independence.
Is there a chance that this just exacerbates an already fraught relationship between two nuclear powers?
You know, we have two choices here. We can just pretend this didn't happen to us when the best intelligence agencies the world has is telling us that it has happened. Or we can decide to make the world know that we are willing to stand up against this kind of attack. This is the new-fangled way to undermine a country's democracy and potentially look at how you undermine their economic system. And if we let this happen to us, it's going to start happening to other countries. And as you sit here on the front line in these Baltic states like we are today, for us to just pretend it's not happening would be not just an insult to them, but really an insult to democracies the world over. And that's why I think it's so important that the president has taken these actions.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
The English city of Sunderland voted overwhelmingly last summer to leave the European Union. That vote put thousands of jobs at risk at Nissan, Sunderland's biggest private employer. So why would people vote against their economic self-interest? Well, NPR's Frank Langford found the answer lies in part with opposition to immigration and a perceived threat to white identity.
The Humbledon and Plains Farm Working Men's Club offers pool, darts, and cheap beer to a local blue-collar community. On Election Day, it also serves as a polling station. About 200 people voted here in last year's election. Turnout for June's Brexit referendum was nearly 40% higher, which caught the attention of Les Scott. He's a former city mayor who monitored the polls that day.
My lasting memory of this polling station was them coming in and saying virtually every time, "What do we do?" So we were obviously experiencing people who'd never, ever voted in their life.
Scott also noticed patriotic symbols like the British flag, which some white nationalists have co-opted in the past.
The national symbols of the Union Jack, which are reasonably common in this area, were being very proudly displayed. We knew then that something was different about this election.
One recent evening, a couple dozen white-haired women descend on the club for country line dancing. They two-step and spin across the worn parquet floor, past a stage draped in American and Confederate flags. Tommy Wardropper sitting in the bar chatting with friends. Wardropper, who works as a plumber, backed Brexit. The reason? To keep foreigners out.
So we don't want more of them coming in. Muslims, immigrants, closing our borders would be better for our country.
Have you guys been following the election in the United States?
I love Trump.
Why do you love Trump?
Because he's going to get rid of all the alien Muslims.
Wardropper wears a soccer jersey featuring a red cross on a white background. It's the St. George's cross, the English flag. Wardropper's proud of his English heritage, but he says in multicultural Britain, cherished symbols like this are increasingly under attack.
We can't even put George Cross flags in our bedroom windows and out.
Wardropper says he's not even allowed to put the flag in his window. That's not true. Driving to the club, we pass two English flags outside homes. Wardropper counters.
Well, you can, but it upsets the Muslims.
Dan Evans, one of Wardropper's drinking buddies, also voted for Brexit. He's tired of the United Kingdom having to follow EU law. And he also says Muslims get special treatment on construction sites because of their faith. Evans spent 2 years building a paint factory inside the Nissan facility. And so I asked him, how important is Nissan to this economy, do you think?
Oh, massive.
Really?
It employs about over 7,000 people.
When you voted to leave, were you worried at all that Nissan might pull out?
No, because at the time I was working there and I was building this multi-million pound factory. And if they were going to leave, they wouldn't have carried on building this factory. They would have
Evans gambled that Nissan was so heavily invested in Sunderland, it wouldn't shut its doors. After the vote, Nissan threatened to halt further investment here, forcing the UK to promise to protect it from any costs imposed by Brexit. Unlike most patrons of the club, Nigel Lee voted to stay in the European Union. Plain-spoken 72-year-old is nursing a whiskey and lemonade near the bar. Lee says the way he sees it, support for Brexit in this community was driven by one thing above all.
I think the main reason we have voted to go out was racism.
For instance, Lee says some people here resent that a nearby Muslim community keeps to itself.
And everybody says they live separate lives. Well, if they're going to get beat up, they're going to... The Irish done it, the Jews done it. They all live in separate conclaves.
If you're struggling with Lee's accent, what he's saying is that Muslims cluster together because they're worried about their safety, and that minorities, including Irish and Jews, have often settled in ethnic enclaves. What's clear in this community is that many here are determined to keep it white, and were willing to risk Sunderland's economy to do so. Frank Langford, NPR News, Sunderland.
This is NPR News.
On the last Friday of 2016, this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8:18. Thanks for listening and stay with us. We'll be bringing you headlines next from NPR and WPR. Hear how a federal court has weighed in on the Wisconsin right to work law. WPR's Sean Johnson brings us that story in a couple of minutes.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Katy Park's annual Ice Fishing Derby will take place the morning of January 21st. The event gives kids the opportunity to ice fish with experienced adults, as well as join in special activities including snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and hiking.
Romance and compassion. February 9th at the Majestic Theater in Madison. Information at wpr.org/love.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Vladimir Putin says Moscow won't respond in kind to U.S. sanctions designed to punish Russia for alleged cyber attacks ahead of last month's presidential election won by Donald Trump. NPR's Lucianne Kim in Moscow says Putin instead is holding out an olive branch to the incoming Trump administration.
Just 2 hours after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov went on state television to recommend expelling 35 American diplomats, Putin made the surprise announcement that they could all stay. Putin called the U.S. sanctions adversarial and provocative, but said Russia would, quote, not stoop to the level of irresponsible diplomacy. Putin said all American diplomats could stay and even invited their children to view the Kremlin Christmas tree.
Yesterday, President Obama announced sanctions against Russian intelligence agencies and the expulsion of 35 Russian diplomats from the U.S. In South Korea, government officials are being criticized over a new map. Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
It was a pink map and website that showed how many women of childbearing age live in each city or region. The government says the page was meant to provide info on the country's low birth rate, but many people here say the site shamed women for not having more babies.
The National Weather Service says there's a high risk of wildfires in a number of states today because of dry air and gusty winds. They include parts of Florida and Texas. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A federal court has struck down a Wisconsin law that would have made it harder for private sector unions to collect dues. Sean Johnson reports.
The provision was part of Wisconsin's right to work law, which took effect last year. It involved the dues checkoff agreements workers signed to let unions deduct dues from their paychecks. The new law would have let workers revoke those agreements with just 30 days' notice. Federal Judge William Connolly ruled that change ran contrary to federal labor law, which says agreements to pay union dues can last a full year. Nathan Eisenberg is one of the lawyers who represented the union.
This allows the union to represent their members and keep the resources that they need to represent their members.
A spokesman for the Wisconsin Department of Justice did not respond to a request for comment. The rest of the right to work law still stands. It prohibits mandatory union dues in private sector businesses. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A quarry owner is not happy with changes a legislative study committee wants to make to burial site protections. Robert Shea, president of Wingrow Stone and Ready Mix, wants to mine Ho-Chunk Nation burial mounds located within a Wingrow quarry in Dane County. He needs a permit since the mounds are in the State Historical Society's burial sites catalog. The tribe is fighting him in court. Legislative leaders formed a committee to revise burial site protections. The panel finalized a bill last week that would require the Historical Society director to consider evidence to catalog a site and allow property owners to fight that decision.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Care.com, offering HomePay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/homepay. From Fidelity, offering wealth planning, using a personal, dedicated relationship to help clients build, manage, and preserve their family's wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services. From Atlassian, maker of collaboration software, Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket. Atlassian works to help teams across industries ascend to new heights to create what's next. At Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Team up. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. At GatesFoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. When Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen makes a swing through Latin America next month, she will stop off in San Francisco and also Houston. Now, anything that looks like support for an independent Taiwan angers China. And China this morning again called for the U.S. to deny the necessary visas for that stopover. This is another irritant in the U.S.-China relationship, which may be headed for change under soon-to-be President Donald Trump. Let's look at the U.S.-China relationship in 2017 with Robert Daly, who's here in the studio with us. He heads the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the nonpartisan Woodrow Wilson Center. Welcome back to the program. Good morning.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So let's think about this. Last month, Donald Trump takes this congratulatory phone call from the president of Taiwan. Now the Obama administration gives her a transit visa. What exactly is going on here?
The transit visa actually was set up before the phone call, so this was expected.
Okay.
As you mentioned, we know that this annoys China, but the Trump administration has made it clear that it is annoyed by China's repeated annoyance and that in its view, it is up to the president or president-elect of the United States who they speak to and to whom they give visas, that China's objections are, to use a Chinese phrase, a gross interference in our internal affairs.
That's formal speak in China.
That's formal speak in China.
So
there will be transits and there are precedents for this, but it appears that there will not be formal meetings, that they will not elevate the visit in ways that would further anger China. It's going to be played down There is a sense that the incoming Trump administration has made its point with the phone call, and it tune in after January 20th.
You say annoyances and then annoyed by annoyances. I mean, it sounds like sort of just a tit for tat, but this can be serious stuff, right? I mean, these are seen as provocations in China that could really build.
This is very serious stuff, because when we established relations with China in 1979, we established as the basis, the foundation for all relations, what is called the One China policy. Mm-hmm. We have accepted that there is only one China. We acknowledge that people on both sides of the Taiwan Straits have a different view of that, but that they also acknowledge one China. So every incoming president, the Reagan's case is a little bit fuzzy, but every incoming American president has reaffirmed the one China principle before taking office to establish our continued interest in relations with China. So this is not a bargaining chip. This is the foundation upon which all bargaining takes place. Talking to Tsai Ing-wen doesn't necessarily violate, as we discussed last time, the policy, the One China policy, but it's a shift in practice that China's deeply worried about.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what China has been doing. I mean, the South China Sea, which we've heard about a lot in 2016, another core interest of China, they've been fortifying these islands this week for the first time. They sent an aircraft carrier into the region. Are those significant moves in the views of the United States and its allies?
Certainly. A decision of the International Court of Arbitration in The Hague earlier in the summer made clear that China's what's called its nine-dash line, it's essentially claim over all of the South China Sea, all of the Western Pacific, has no basis in international law, and that these islands China has built out do not, under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, have the status of islands. They are mere rocks that don't grant China a territorial sea. Mm-hmm. But China is behaving as if they do. So this is a challenge to international law, which the United States has had a major role in upholding since World War II. So yes, these are seen as provocative moves.
Robert Daly, wasn't this seen as the peaceful, prosperous, stable region in an otherwise pretty difficult, tense world? Why wouldn't it be in everyone's interest to just say, let's keep it that way?
Well, everyone does say that they want to keep it that way. And yes, it's been extremely peaceful and prosperous. 60% of the world's population is in Asia. 2/3 of the world's growth is in Asia. And this is one of the reasons that we have very strong interests there. What has changed primarily is China has risen. China has become more wealthy. And like all big continental powers that get wealthy, it has also grown its military, and it wants to shape its environment to suit its needs.
But that's been going on for a while, right? I mean, is there something new today that might be worrying a new president like Donald Trump when he comes in?
It has escalated under the Chinese leader Xi Jinping. The island building has escalated. It had been pursued initially under his successor. China likes to say, well, Vietnam has built out islands. The Philippines, other countries have built out islands. That really doesn't wash with the United States or China's neighbors, because China's building of islands over the past 3 years is 17 times greater in total area than all of the other claimants combined over 40 years. This is huge. Everything with China is enormous. And as China's recent seizure of an American drone makes clear, China's attitude appears to be that it will call the shots in this vast, vitally important area, which does not serve America's interests. It doesn't allow us to uphold our alliance relations with Japan and South Korea. And it also flies in the face of international law.
Okay. Speaking with Robert Daly of the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is New Year's Eve, and people all around the country will raise a toast or kiss a special someone to ring in 2017. This week, we asked you to share your very special good luck traditions with us here at Morning Edition.
Deborah and Jim Purden of Maplewood, New Jersey, wrote us how they eat sardines on New Year's Eve.
Delicious.
And then on New Year's Day, they have a meal of pork roasted in sauerkraut.
That sounds better to me. Here's Anaki Garcia from Salt Lake City, Utah.
My family is from Texas and had the tradition of eating black-eyed peas every New Year's Day. And every bean you eat is supposed to be $1 you make in the new year. So as a kid, I would look at this giant bowl of black-eyed peas and think, this is amazing. I'm going to have so much money. And now as an adult, I look at it and I was like, oh man, that's all.
But black-eyed peas are not the only food meant to usher in fortune. It turns out there are foods you don't even have to eat, and they still bring you luck. We talked to Ahu Mosier on Skype, and she told us about this tradition that she learned from her mother while she was growing up in Turkey.
She used to smash a pomegranate on our doorstep.
But if you're looking for something that requires a little less cleanup, Christine Rayum of Idlewild, California, told us about her family's New Year's ritual.
The first person through the entrance of the house had to be a male.
So right before midnight, either my father or one of my brothers would go outdoors in the freezing cold and wait until midnight and then come in and we would all cheer. My mother was Portuguese, and I think it came from her side of the family.
Go out in the freezing cold. Doesn't sound...
Whatever brings you
whatever
luck, man.
Brings you luck. Whatever. Well, we are wishing all of you good luck and also a safe and happy new year from us here at Morning Edition.
Indeed.
We're up all night to get lucky. 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 We're up all night to get lucky.
We're up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get lucky.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
David Bowie, Prince, and George Michael all redefined what it meant to be manly.
These ideas of gender are these acquired notions, and I think that if you see this person signifying none of it, it kind of blows your mind.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How three musicians who died in 2016 changed our perception of masculinity. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It is 8:30 and you're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. We'll meet a New Year's baby. That's in 15 minutes on Wisconsin Public Radio. In Wisconsin news, the new state transportation study finds that installing tollways on Wisconsin interstates could raise billions of dollars, but that substantial upfront investments would be needed and federal approval is uncertain. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that the Department of Transportation study also finds that Governor Scott Walker's road funding plan for the next 2 years puts Wisconsin roads on a path to worsen severely over the next decade. Wisconsin lawmakers and Walker commissioned the study last year as part of the 2015-2017 state budget. Its findings were released this week. A day earlier, Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb announced his resignation, effective next month, with little explanation. Walker's office did not immediately respond to the newspaper's request for comment on the study. Lawmakers are expected to address state transportation funding in the upcoming legislative session. A woman accused with two men in the fatal beating of a Milwaukee man that was captured on Snapchat has pleaded not guilty. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that 20-year-old Sarah Zakseski waived her rights to a preliminary hearing yesterday and was bound over for trial. Zakseski and brothers, 20-year-old Devin Katzfey and 19-year-old Brandon Katzfey, are charged as parties to first-degree reckless homicide in the death last week of 20-year-old Delvin Mendoza Chaparro. This is WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from MG&E, committed to building a community energy company for the future by working together to reduce carbon emissions and provide more renewable resources. More at energy2030together.com.
Support for WGTD and NPR in Walworth County comes from Broggy Coffee House and Wine Bar in Williams Bay, offering live music, special events, local fine arts and crafts, and homemade specialty dishes. Details online at BroggyCoffeeWineMusicArt.com.
It will be partly to mostly cloudy on this final Friday of 2016. Highs will be in the lower to mid-20s today. And tonight there's a chance of snow and a slight chance of light freezing rain through the night. Temperatures will be in the high teens and in the mid-20s near Lake Michigan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Diane and Hal Brierly in support of NPR's work to engage its audience in the discussion of today's issues and provide in-depth journalism and thought-provoking stories. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, committed to improving public policy, invigorating civic life, and turning indifference into action. More information is available at pewtrusts.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. An unexpected reaction this morning from Vladimir Putin. Russia's president announced that he will not retaliate against the U.S. for expelling 35 Russian operatives yesterday. President Obama kicked the diplomats out and issued economic sanctions against Russia for allegedly interfering in the U.S. presidential election. We're joined now by the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. He joins us via Skype. Ambassador, thanks for being with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
In a statement issued this morning, Russian President Putin said, and I'm quoting here, "We're not going to stoop to the level of irresponsible diplomacy, and we will take future steps to restore Russian-American relations." So what's going on here? Is Putin trying to take the moral high ground?
Well, he's just waiting for President-elect Trump. That's very obvious. He thinks, with good reason, by the way, that President-elect Trump wants to have better relations with Russia. And therefore, he's decided that it's not necessary and no reason to antagonize the U.S.-Russian relations even further. And so he's just waiting for January 20th.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, who's on a trip to Eastern Europe this week, told us on this program that there are already concerns among our European allies that Russia could engage in a similar cyber attack in their elections. Are these sanctions that the Obama administration has now slapped on Russia, are they likely to stop Russia from engaging in similar attacks?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a good first step. It shows the seriousness of what they did in our elections. Most importantly, in my view, is that it attributes very directly to Russia this intervention in our presidential election. But will these level of sanctions stop them from trying to do similar things in other elections in other countries? I don't think so. I think it'll take a greater effort over time.
The Obama administration said the reason that they kicked out the Russian operatives was in response to the harassment of American diplomats in Russia. And presumably they were just using this moment to take that action. As a former U.S. diplomat in Russia, what can you tell us about that harassment?
Well, the level of harassment of our diplomats in the embassy I used to work in, I think today is probably greater than any time in U.S.-Russian or U.S.-Soviet relations. It got bad when I was ambassador from 2012 after there were these demonstrations against the Russian regime. Mr. Putin blamed us. Blamed Obama and blamed me personally, by the way, for fomenting revolution against his government. It was a false claim. I want to underscore that we were not in no way seeking to overthrow Mr. Putin's government. But in retaliation, they took all kinds of actions.
Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, I mean, you know, petty things like slashing tires of diplomats, breaking into apartments and moving things around just to let people know that they are being followed. And I personally was followed and my family was followed in a way to let it be known that we're being followed.
Just briefly, what's a Trump presidency going to mean for U.S.-Russian relations?
I don't know. You know, I think so far, President-elect Trump has confused ends and means in diplomacy. He has said many times, I want to get along with Russia. Wouldn't it be nice if we got along with Russia? But unfortunately, in my view, that is not a policy. That is not an objective. That's a means to some other ends. And so far, in terms of U.S. national security objectives or economic objectives, I don't know exactly what he wants to achieve with Mr. Putin, but we'll find out soon.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. He's a professor of political science now at Stanford. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Mummers Parade in Philadelphia is thought to be the oldest folk parade in the country. Since 1901, participants have marched up Broad Street dressed in extravagant costumes every New Year's Day. The routines often satirize current events or pop culture, and sometimes they can be offensive. So this year, the Mummers went through sensitivity training to help them rein in their antics. From member station WHYY, here's Peter Crimmins.
The Mummers have a long history of getting into trouble. In the 19th century, guys would dress up on New Year's Day and horse around their neighborhoods, doing a lot of drinking and fighting. So in 1901, the city of Philadelphia convinced them to march up Broad Street together, largely to keep an eye on them. This year, a few days before Christmas, about 60 musicians congregated in an IKEA parking lot in South Philadelphia to practice. This is the Freilinger String Band. It's been around for over a century, and like most Mummers clubs, it spends a better part of the year putting together its costumes and routines. Saxophonist Steve Koper has worn face paint, donned sequins, and marched every New Year's Day for 47 years.
It's a 4.5-minute semi-professional production, and we're very proud of that. However, when we do pick themes, We have to be aware of modern times.
The Mummers are a lot less raucous than they were a century ago, but some still managed to get in trouble.
There was a lot of anger last year with several of the things that happened.
That's because last year, some Mummers depicted Latinos by wearing brown face and dressing their children as tacos. Still others mocked Caitlyn Jenner. Another group made fun of the Black Lives Matter movement. The routines were captured on bystander cell phones and posted online, and Rue Landau, the director of Philadelphia's Commission on Human Relations, heard all about it.
Every year, the Commission on Human Relations gets informal complaints about Mummers' skits.
So this year, Landau coordinated a program of sensitivity trainings for the Mummers to teach the fundamentals of cultural appropriation and some basics about the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. Workshops were held in bars and community centers. Jennifer Childs, a local theater performer, led one on the difference between appropriate and offensive satire.
Part of this is joyous. A part of this is going like, wow, you guys spent a year sewing sequins on that outfit. You look amazing. You want people talking about that, not about, oh, did you see that jackass with, you know, blackface on?
The training was entirely voluntary, and Landau, the human relations commissioner, says nobody knows what's going to happen this New Year's Day until it happens.
We just had an election with somebody sends a message out to all of America, say and do whatever you want to do, and you have the Mummers leadership saying, pull it together, reel it in. So if there's ever been a challenge for the Mummers, this is the year.
For NPR News, I'm Peter Crimmins in Philadelphia.
This is NPR News.
And it is 8:41, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy Friday. Happy final Friday of 2016. Thanks for tuning in and stay with us. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR. That's followed by Wisconsin Life, and in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, break out the Kleenex. It's our annual musical montage of some musicians who passed away in 2016, or you can also dance in celebration. That montage in 10 minutes.
Hi, it's Chris Thaley. On behalf of all of us here at A Prairie Home Companion, thank you so much for welcoming the new version of the show into your homes. What a season it's been so far. And since this is the perfect weekend for a bit of reflection, we've assembled a few of my favorite moments from past shows. We hope you'll join us. We wish you a happy and safe new year and can't wait to get back in January.
Saturday night at 5 on the Ideas Network.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Syria's nationwide ceasefire appears to be holding, though some fighting is reported near Damascus and in central Hama province. NPR's Alice Fordham reports.
No deaths were reported in the first hours of the ceasefire, and people on the ground say there has been a definite downturn in violence, though some opposition activists say government forces are still attacking them in areas near Damascus. Several previous truces have lasted a few days before collapsing.
This latest ceasefire took effect at midnight local time. Dylan Roof is to undergo another competency exam before the sentencing phase of his murder trial in South Carolina. Roof is the person who opened fire during a Bible study last year at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. Cooper McKim with South Carolina Public Radio reports.
A federal judge ordered another evaluation of Roof in an abundance of caution. A jury found 22-year-old Dylan Roof guilty on all 33 federal counts for the shooting deaths of 9 black worshippers. Roof faces the death penalty. The judge's order says Roof will be evaluated over the weekend at a Charleston County jail. He will then rule on Roof's competency as the week begins. The sentencing phase of the trial is set to begin January 3rd.
The U.S. Coast Guard is searching Lake Erie for signs of a small plane with 6 people aboard. It took off late last night from Cleveland, heading for Columbus, Ohio. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 9 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Ice fishing on Wisconsin's inland lakes can be a dicey proposition in this year's relatively mild winter. The DNR routinely warns anglers that no ice is 100% safe. Patty Murray reports a businessman who pulls cars out of lakes agrees.
Don Herman volunteers with Oshkosh's Otter Street Fishing Club and runs the Sunk and Dive Ice Service.
I pull all the cars that fall through the lake around here.
That's mostly Lakes Winnebago, Poygan, and Butamore. He charges $700 an hour. He says northeastern Wisconsin hasn't had enough cold days yet for lakes to fully freeze.
You need about 2 weeks of below zero weather and the lake's good for driving.
Herman urges fishermen to contact fishing clubs or bait shops to get current information on local conditions. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
An inmate from Iowa with a history of violence toward guards and one daring escape has been found dead in a Wisconsin cell 1 month after he was transferred there. Authorities said yesterday that 26-year-old Justin Kestner was found unresponsive at Dodge Correctional Institution in Waupun, Wisconsin on December 21st. The Iowa Department of Corrections says prison staff initiated life-saving measures but were unsuccessful. A medical examiner says autopsy results have not been completed. Prison officials and the county sheriff are investigating. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Care.com, offering HomePay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/homepay. From Amazon, whose original series The Man in the High Castle imagines a world where the Allies lost World War II and America's ruled by Nazi Germany and imperialist Japan. All episodes streaming now on Amazon Prime Video. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and now it is time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik on someone's 15 minutes of fame.
Every new year comes with a New Year's baby. It's a big job to be a newly birthed minor celebrity. Mike Paulus shares his story.
Somewhere in my parents' house, deep in a box in the basement, there's a newspaper clipping. A gray and white photo and a caption. It shows a young woman on the very first day of 1976. She looks tired. She looks like she wasn't really ready for a newspaper photographer to show up at the door, ask her to smile, and take her picture. She's sitting up in bed, and she's holding a baby. Spoiler alert, I am that baby. Only back when this photo was taken, I was way smaller, I had a lot less hair, and as you may have guessed, I was freshly birthed. Mom and I both were a little out of sorts, although Mom at least had been through childbirth before with my older sister, Sarah. However, as I very much enjoy pointing out, Sarah didn't have a newspaper man show up just because she was born. It was dumb luck, but I'll take it. I was a New Year's baby. On January 1st, 1976, I was the first baby born in Monroe, Wisconsin. And for about 10 seconds, or however long it takes for the average Monroean to read a two-sentence caption, I was a minor celebrity. And my mom and dad? Well, they had just won a big contest. It was staged by the local paper. They won all kinds of prizes just because I popped into existence after all of the clocks in the middle of America had ticked past midnight and no one else in Monroe had. They won practical things like diapers, but if memory serves, they also won some pizza and some beer and lots of other stuff. So, as soon as I was born, my parents owed me, big time. Not really. My mom was the real hero that night. And I'm not sure if you believe in luck. I mean, we barely know each other, but I believe that I've led a very lucky life. I know great people, and I seem to fall into interesting opportunities. So, perhaps something magical happened on that chilly night back in the 1970s. As people partied at the local bars and raised their cups to the new year ahead, perhaps a giant wave of hopeful energy rose up and then poured down from the starry sky, flooding the hospital at the very moment I came into the world. Maybe I was born already wrapped up in a blanket of luck. Or maybe I just have good, solid, generous parents and enough sense to hang out with good, solid, generous people. We may never know. But one thing's for sure. When I see that old newspaper clipping and look at my young mother's face, at the, is my hair okay, can you please leave now, look in her tired eyes, I'm absolutely filled with gratitude. for all of the good things in my life and especially the people who have provided me with so much warmth and care. So thank you, Monroe, and thank you, Mom. Happy New Year.
Mike Paulus is the online editor of Volume 1 in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Thank you so much for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, Morning Edition continues as they remember musicians who died in the past year. And coming your way soon, it's Morning Classics with Ruth Ann Bestman. Works included on the playlist are a box concert for two violins and a flute quartet by Mozart. Join us for Morning Classics on WPR in about 10 minutes.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
In this celebration of the Christmas season, WPR is pleased to support cultural celebrations from around the world. More information at WPR.org/events.
It'll be a cloudy day today in Wisconsin. Highs will be in the lower to mid-20s, and tonight there is a chance of snow and a slight chance of light freezing rain through the night. Temperatures will be in the high teens, except in the lower to mid-20s, closer to Lake Michigan.
Support for WPR is provided by the Eduardo Neal Silva Young Artists Fund. In memory of his dedication to young performers, Eduardo Neal Silva was a respected educator at the University of Wisconsin and dedicated listener to WPR.
Supporting WGTD is the Metropolitan Opera, whose next high-definition simulcast is Saturday, January 7th, Giuseppe Verdi's early masterwork Nabucco, at Kenosha's Tinseltown and Racine's Renaissance Theater. More information at metopera.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. We're going to spend some time now remembering some of the musicians we lost this past year, and there were sadly a lot of them, so many we couldn't fit them all into the montage you're about to hear. You will recognize some, including this purple icon of pop.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time, but I'm here to tell you. There's something else. The afterworld. Just remember, lovers never lose.
But we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you.
Where has the time all gone to? Haven't done half the things we want to. Oh, well.
Yo, my
Microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? The 5 foot assassin with the roughneck business. I float like gravity, never had a cavity. Got more rhymes than the one that's got family.
Sitting there yakking right in my face. I guess I'm gonna have to put you in your place. You know, if silence was golden, you couldn't raise a dime.
100 days, 100 nights to know a man's heart. So girls, take my advice. Think it over once or twice.
I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days.
Take me away and turn back the years. Sing me back home before I die.
Friends, me and this old man was like desperados waiting for a train.
He said all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them, but he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone.
Como quisiera que tú vivieras.
Not so sweet.
Let me guide you to the purple rain. Purple rain, purple rain.
All right, a montage of the work of just some of the musical artists we lost in the year 2016, ending right now with the work of producer George Martin. Now, for more on these and other musicians we lost in 2016, visit NPR Music. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. This is WPR, where there's news for you throughout the day, with headlines every hour, the BBC News Hour at 3, and All Things Considered at 4.
Support for WPR comes from the Milwaukee Symphony, screening Raiders of the Lost Ark while the symphony performs the soundtrack live at the Marcus Center December 30th and a 2:30 matinee on New Year's Eve. MSO.org/WPR.
Support for WGTD comes from the staff of Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, who understand the holidays can seem hopeless, but there is hope, help, and support by texting HOPELINE to 741741. Someone will listen or be a resource for you to give you help and hope. Text HOPELINE to 741741.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine,